You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Mitchell B. Reese is president of Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, and was previously diplomat in residence at the College of William and Mary. He served as director of the Office of Policy Planning at the U.S. State Department under Secretary of State Colin Powell. From 2003 to 2007, Mr. Reese served as the president's special envoy for the Northern Ireland peace process. He received the State Department's Foreign Affairs Award for Public Service in 2007. In his latest book, Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists, Mr. Reese examines the challenges involved in seeking a diplomatic resolution in the war on terror. It's published by Open Road Media, and I'm pleased it brings him to our program. Hello, Mitchell.
Good morning.
You know, I was going to say I'm honored that you're talking to me, but it seems like you're in favor of talking to a lot of people. So I shouldn't be that honored, I suppose. I'm really not evil by anyone's definition. Well, maybe by somebody's definition. This book is fascinating because by definition, you're talking about negotiating with some of the most sketchy characters, I guess I would say, in the world, some terrorist organizations that we don't usually think of as sitting down across the table from government officials. So as a result, you're talking about some of the most dramatic conflicts of the last century, which makes for very gripping reading. But I guess a couple of things really jumped out at me. We're sort of living in an age of the war on terror. I guess it's not called the war on terror anymore, but certainly George W. Bush called it that. And we sort of, especially living in New York after 9/11, we got the sense that terror was everywhere. It was all around us. Tremendous sense of this all-pervasive threat. And yet, in your book, you have a startling statistic about how many Americans have actually been killed in an international terrorist attack. Do you remember how you stated that? It was sort of startling to me.
Well, over the past 30 years, about 3,600 Americans have been killed by terrorist attacks. And statistically, it's the same number that have been killed by lightning. Mm-hmm. Now, it's easy to draw, I think, the wrong conclusion from that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying or trivializing the effect of terrorist attacks because they're vastly different. There is no comparison. But rather, we need to understand that there are a variety of terrorist groups that are out there in the world today. Some of them you absolutely cannot talk to. They are what I call irreconcilable. They have maximalist, all-or-nothing agendas. These are people that you need to either kill or capture or wait until their thinking evolves, if it ever does. However, there may be other groups out there who are reconcilable, who may have more limited or localized grievances that we might be able to accommodate without compromising our national security interests. And it's how do you tell the difference between the irreconcilables and the reconcilables that the book really addresses.
And when you're absolutely right, we can't trivialize those numbers because after all, you know, 3,000 people, you know, it's still a lot to all those people and to the families of the people. However, isn't that kind of the goal of terrorism? Is you're not killing a million people, you're killing, you know, a few dozen here or there, and that's going to create fear and terrorize large populations.
Well, different terrorist groups have different agendas, and certainly the idea of creating fear among the population is one of them, and it's our ability to fight through that very natural impulse. The reality is that these groups are around us all the time. You only have to look at the headlines to see from last week Hamas launching rocket and mortar attacks into southern Israel to try to disrupt the Israeli-Palestinian talks. The Basque terrorist group ETA declaring a unilateral ceasefire and asking the government to reengage in peace talks. Bombings in Iraq and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda still killing our forces in Afghanistan. So terrorism is part of the world today. It's not going away. We cannot kill or capture all of them. So the book addresses the question, is it possible to peel away some of these people and have some type of negotiated solution with some of them?
Now, in America, we've always heard our politicians, our leaders say, we do not negotiate with terrorists. And that's almost become a watchword. We hear that constantly. And yet, in your book, you talk about the history of negotiating with terrorists, and it's actually fairly storied. It goes back hundreds, even thousands of years, by your definition. Do you want to sort of walk us through the beginning of negotiating with evil? When did it start? Shortly after the appearance of evil, or when? How long have we been doing this?
Well, the title of the book, Negotiating with Evil, actually comes from a speech that Vice President Cheney gave in December 2002, in which he said, "We don't negotiate with evil, we defeat it." The reality is that American politicians from both parties, since the founding of our country, have actually been negotiating with enemy states and with terrorist groups, starting with the Founding Fathers, who negotiated with the Barbary Pirates. We originally had legislation that paid the Barbary Pirates $2 million a year so they wouldn't attack American merchant vessels. So this is a long history. More recently, under President Reagan, the Iran-Contra scandal had us dealing with some pretty unsavory characters. The Clinton administration had overtures to Hamas. Even the Bush administration was talking to the Iranian regime and to the North Koreans. So again, there is a culture where we demonize these people for very good reasons. They are unspeakably horrific in what they do. But the reality is that administrations do talk to them. The book really asks the question, how can you do this in an intelligent way, and how can you avoid some of the mistakes that other countries have experienced in the past?
Is the value of demonizing the people, is that a political value? What is the rationale? If we know on some level that we're going to have some people making indirect overtures to terrorists, why are we coming out and saying the axis of evil and we don't negotiate? Is that to so the politician looks tough and looks strong, or is it to whip up morale as a country? Why do we do that?
Well, I'm not completely cynical about the motives that some politicians have. Mm-hmm. These people are evil. They do inflict unspeakable horror on innocent civilians, whether as a government, as a regime, like in North Korea or Iran, or whether as a terrorist organization. So there is an ethical or moral component to what the politician is saying. The problem is, how can the government back away from that, or how can the government then explain to the domestic audience that even though these people are evil, we still need to talk to them under certain circumstances so that we can prevent future horrors? And that's really the difficulty for the government. Some governments have handled it better than others.
Well, this became an issue in the 2008 campaign, didn't it? Because I remember vividly in one of the debates between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the question was, would you negotiate with Iran and North Korea, et cetera, et cetera? And Barack Obama said, yes, I would. And Hillary said, absolutely not.
Well, and, Senator Obama then, the question was, would he negotiate during his first year as president without any preconditions with the leaders of some pretty despicable regimes? And he said he would. And Senator Clinton almost had an aneurysm right there. The Republican candidates then piled on. And again, you can make the distinction between the president's impulse, which may have been sensible, versus the tactics, which is under no condition should the president of the United States invite these world leaders into the Oval Office or the Rose Garden during his first year, unless an awful lot of spade work had been done to prepare for the meeting. These regimes are going to use that type of encounter for propaganda purposes, for their own interests. And it's not clear that unless you have really done a lot of work ahead of time, that type of meeting is going to be productive for the United States.
I can just interrupt for a second. We have an update from the WNYC newsroom. A fire in Harlem is forcing a shutdown of Grand Central Station. Metro North Station in and out of Grand Central has been suspended. So a little news update there. I'm actually talking to Mitchell Reese, the author of Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists. This is Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate here on WNYC and WNYC.org. And we will keep you up to date on more details of that fire in Harlem as we get them. So you talk about, you mentioned this briefly before, the key is to find out who the groups are that we can talk to, and also when is the actual time that's right. Because it's interesting, you go through in this book some of the most protracted, grinding campaigns of terror when governments had a lot of contact with the terror groups. And I guess one sort of the signal examples is the Troubles in Northern Ireland, which is kind of the centerpiece of your book. I know that's I would never ask you to summarize the Troubles in 2 minutes or less, but you said something interesting in your discussion of the Troubles, which is that there are times when governments negotiated with the IRA and didn't necessarily come to a conclusion, come to any kind of a ceasefire or a peace, but it was still not really a waste of time or a missed opportunity. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's right. Is it not every engagement with a terrorist group is set in mind with reaching a political conclusion, a peace agreement, if you will? Some governments decide that these people are truly irreconcilable or that they haven't evolved enough in their thinking to compromise some of their core principles. So what the government decides to do is to engage for a very different reason, and it's really a counterintelligence exercise. The idea is to try to gain greater insight into the organization, to try to see who is in control of the organization, where the levers of power are, what some of the factions and rivalries might be within the organization so that you can sow distrust, and of course also use these opportunities to try to recruit some of the terrorist individuals over to your side so they can inform on their comrades. The British were extraordinarily successful in doing this. It took a while for them, decades actually, but they were able to infiltrate the IRA to the extent that the number three official inside the IRA was a British informant, and the head of the IRA's counterintelligence operations was actually a British informant as well. So they had a great deal of success. And again, that's very different than negotiation. And again, the challenge for the government is you have to be clear in your mind which pathway you're going down. Are you trying to reach a peaceful resolution, or is this really a counterintelligence exercise?
Does the mission ever change in the course of negotiation? Do you ever sit down across the table with somebody and say, maybe they're not as reasonable as I thought. Maybe I should work on infiltrating and messing them up?
Well, I think it does. I think that the two lines blur. And of course, you could start as a counterintelligence operation and realize that, in fact, there's some genuine new thinking going on inside the organization, and you want to see if you can develop that. It's very difficult for these organizations, in particular for a terrorist, to have the imagination to renounce violence, a lifestyle that they've known probably from a very young age, and to imagine a new way forward so that they can actually enter into some type of political bargain. It's extraordinarily hard to find individuals with that skill set, the ability to act with authority and to speak with discretion, the ability to have the charisma to persuade their comrades that they need to follow them out of this darkness, if you will, and into a pathway that promised some resolution of the crisis. Those individuals are extraordinarily hard to find. Northern Ireland was very fortunate in having that individual in Gerry Adams. That type of skill set that Adams has doesn't exist with Hamas, with Hezbollah, with the Tamil Tigers, with a whole host of terrorist organizations around the world. Unless you can identify that person in advance, any type of serious engagement is doomed to failure.
My guest is Mitchell Reese. His book, Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists, is published by Open Road. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate this week. I'm talking to Mitchell B. Reese, the author of Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists, for WNYC, WNYC.org. So you talk in a very informed way about the Northern Ireland campaign of terror and the way it was unwound, because you were actually involved in the negotiations that led to success. Can you tell me a little bit about your role and how that came about, how you came to be sitting across the table?
Well, sure. I was asked by Secretary Powell if I was interested in representing the U.S. government in these talks, and I said that I was. I think one of the main reasons for that was because of my upbringing in Boston, Mass., which has a very large Irish-American community. And so I went to school with a lot of Irish-Americans, and this was part of the culture of my upbringing. I was then assigned to the talks and met with British officials, Irish officials, and all the leading political parties in Northern Ireland, and did that for about 3.5 years. And during that time, we were able to move the peace process forward so that eventually Ian Paisley's party and Gerry Adams' party were able to reach an agreement and able to restore local government for the people of Northern Ireland. So it was a great moment.
And why do you feel, I know it was very complicated, so it's hard to give a glib response, but since that was a very successful example of negotiating with these, you have a comment, there's a joke in the book, which I hope some people don't find in bad taste, but it sort of sums up the problem in Ireland, which, as you said, you referred to this old joke about Irish Alzheimer's. How is that defined?
Well, an Irish official told me on my first trip over there if I understood the definition of Irish Alzheimer's, and I said no, and he said you forget everything except your grievances.
Mm-hmm. That would apply to other ethnic groups as well.
It applies to almost every ethnic group in every conflict around the world. These people have huge rearview mirrors. And quite legitimate grievances in many cases. And it was understanding what grievances were legitimate and which ones weren't, and being able to try to address some of those that was really part of the work there. The key goal for any negotiator, I think, is having empathy. It's not necessarily siding with anybody across the table from you, but absolutely trying to understand where they're coming from with all the cultural and historical legacy that they're dealing with. And in Northern Ireland, there were some legitimate grievances by the Catholic minority in the north about discrimination. Over time, I think those were addressed properly. Policing and the legal system was really the toughest nut to crack, and those were the last ones that we were able to solve.
You mentioned that you had grown up in Boston, in the Boston area, and so you knew a lot of Irish Americans. Does it complicate the negotiation process when there is a domestic population in this country that's from the country that's affected? Does that create more problems for politicians if they appear to be too soft on the wrong side or not playing fair according to some groups at home?
Well, it certainly can. In the case of Northern Ireland, Irish America could not have been more helpful. They were a tremendous force for good, going back to the Four Horsemen, the times of Hugh Carey, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Tip O'Neill, and Teddy Kennedy, renouncing the support, financial and otherwise, for the IRA. Also promoting a human rights and equality agenda in Northern Ireland, desegregation of education in the North. All of this was massively popular. And a turning point in the Troubles was when Irish America sent an unequivocal message to Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin that terrorism was no longer going to be tolerated, that the vigilante justice that the IRA dispensed was no longer going to be acceptable, and that Adams had to lead the way to a different place.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were also involved in some conversations with North Korea, and we don't usually think of North Korea, the North Korean government, as being particularly chatty. Like they're not the most sort of open society in the world. How did you find yourself talking to them, and what were the nature of your discussions?
Well, for 4 years, I was a chief negotiator of an organization that was set up here in New York City to try to persuade the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons program. I got this job because I wrote a book that was very critical of the Clinton administration's diplomacy with North Korea. And I think the State Department thought to themselves, well, if Reese thinks it's so easy, why doesn't he give it a shot himself? So we met with the North Koreans in New York and in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, numerous times over the course of these 4 years, trying to get them to cease their nuclear weapons activities that we objected to, in return for building two civilian nuclear power plants. Now, ultimately, the deal unraveled, and we are in a much more difficult situation today with the North.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any insight into how that might change, or how negotiations with the North could start up again in a more positive way, or is it you know, a situation as long as Kim Jong-il and his son, I guess, who's about to is on the launching pad. As long as they're in charge, is it going to be kind of a non-starter, or what do you feel?
Well, for a number of years, clearly I thought that there was a negotiated pathway forward. I think that the program is so far advanced right now, and the paranoia in the North is so deeply entrenched that it's very difficult for me to imagine a negotiated solution where they would trust us enough to surrender basically their insurance card. All they have are nuclear weapons. They're surrounded by enemies. They're impoverished, and they don't have a lot of friends, and they don't have a lot of assets in the world. The only advantage they have is that they can create trouble for others. So I don't think it's possible to negotiate a solution, and I don't think that we'll get a resolution of this issue until Kim Jong-il passes from the scene, which may take place in the next year or two. Then there'll be an opportunity to see if the regime can transition to this younger generation you mentioned, his 20-something-year-old son. Mm-hmm. So that'll be an opportunity. But again, many countries in the region do not want to see North Korea unravel. The Chinese in particular continue to provide it with energy and humanitarian assistance in order to prop it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that may continue even with a regime change.
Mm-hmm. But it's tricky because China wants to prop it up, and yet we have many, many interlocking arrangements with China. I mean, China owns pretty much all of our debt and everything else. And do we have the opportunity to persuade the Chinese to be helpful in this, or are they not really playing ball with us?
Well, we've tried over the years, mm-hmm. and the Chinese always cry that they don't have as much influence as we think they do. We obviously think they could do more. But the bottom line is that everybody likes Korea so much they're happy there's two of them.
Mm-hmm.
This is the reality. China is right next door. They don't want to have millions of North Korean refugees flooding over the border and destabilizing their northeast frontier. And so it's a small investment for them to continue to keep North Korea on life support. As long as that structural relationship is present, it's going to be very hard to either provide a lot of leverage on the North to get rid of their nuclear weapons or to hope for the day when North Korea may no longer exist.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to Mitchell Reese, the author of Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists. So we're ticking our way through the axis of evil. We've done North Korea. You solved that for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's move on to Iran, who I guess their nuclear program is getting off to the races too, from what we understand. What do we do about them?
Well, the administration is trying to ratchet up the pressure on the Iranians through economic sanctions, and again, the difficulty is getting the key economic players, China, Russia, the European Union, to adopt as stringent economic measures as we'd like. We've had a little bit of success, but clearly not enough in order to have the mullahs in Tehran fundamentally rethink their devotion to this nuclear weapons program. And it may be that no amount of leverage, no amount of pressure could deter them from doing what they appear hell-bent on doing, which is acquiring a nuclear weapons capability.
Mm-hmm. Now, you in the book, you talk about a successfully terminated history or campaign of terror, like the Troubles in Northern Ireland. But you talk about others that end quite differently, like the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. Can you compare and contrast, if you will, talk about how the conversations with them, the government's really repeated failure to seize opportunities there played out?
Sure. The great tragedy of Sri Lanka was that they were faced with an irreconcilable terrorist in this man called Prabhakaran, who only wanted an independent Tamil state in the north and eastern part of the country. And this was unacceptable to every Sri Lankan government, regardless of political persuasion. Many overtures were made to the Tamil Tigers to accept something less than that, a great deal of autonomy, a federated structure, the ability to control things in their own region, but something short of an independent state. The Tamil Tigers rejected that out of hand. And this was the great tragedy, is that there was no negotiated pathway forward for the Sri Lankan government. A few years ago, they decided to wage a war literally to the death. And they were able to kill the leader, kill an awful lot of other members of the Tamil Tigers. And there's an opportunity now for the government to reconcile, to be magnanimous in victory, to reach out to the Tamil diaspora, many of which are here in the United States and elsewhere overseas, and also to reconstitute and to regenerate life for the poor Tamils that have had to suffer this civil war for the last two or three decades.
Well, now, at the beginning, you talked about when you can tell that you've got a terror group that can't really be spoken to as a sort of a maximalist view of their campaign. Where would you put al-Qaeda? I know al-Qaeda and the Taliban are two different things, but let's first talk about al-Qaeda. Could you ever envision a situation where the United States or NATO or representatives of states would be sitting across a table from the leaders of al-Qaeda? I guess we'd have to first get them to show up, which is a tricky situation.
Yeah. Well, the good news would be we'd know where if they did show up. I think more seriously, we'd have to be very clear in our own minds that this wasn't a negotiation, but rather this was a counterintelligence exercise. Mm-hmm. I asked every security officer, intelligence officer I met, would they be willing to sit down with Osama bin Laden? To a man, they all immediately said yes, not because they had any illusions that this would lead to some type of reconciliation, but rather because it would provide a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to gain insight into how this man is thinking, into the structure of the organization, and for us then to be able to defeat it more with more tools. To gain insight is really the key here. So not for negotiation, but rather as a counterintelligence exercise, it would be useful to have the right people with the right skill set meet with al-Qaeda operatives.
Well, I hope that bin Laden doesn't listen to the low-paid show, because if he does, that whole plan that you just laid out has been completely exposed. So that would be a shame.
Well, the interesting thing is, again, from these personal interviews I conducted, is that a lot of these terrorists are actually flattered when they're contacted. By government officials. They like the attention. In some ways, they feel that it validates them. And so they're a little conflicted because they're nervous about these meetings, and yet they still are eager to have them in many cases. And so even if they listen to your show, Andy, they still may be willing to meet with some of our representatives.
But of course, you know, we talked a lot about, or the government talked a lot about, the success of the so-called Sunni awakening. And wasn't that really negotiating with people who previously had been insurgents and were sort of the them and the us versus them construct?
There's no doubt that many of the people that our U.S. military officers talked with in Anbar province had American blood on their hands. And General Odierno was very clear about this in the command guidance that he gave the troops. He addressed it head on, and he said that you may not like it, but that's the way forward. And we couldn't do anything about what's happened in the past, but the general and the political leadership wanted to make sure that fewer American soldiers would die in the future. Those Sunni tribes that would partner with us became our allies in a war against al-Qaeda and were able to actually turn the tide in Anbar province. It's a remarkable story.
Now, in terms of the Taliban, this is a very controversial issue right now, because there's a lot of discussion about what the end game is. I'm saying with wishful thinking that there is an end game in Afghanistan. And a lot of people say, well, the end game involves some kind of conversations with the Taliban. Is that the way you see things ultimately resolving there? Or is at some point the calculus either becomes destroy them or talk to them? Where would you put the Taliban in that calculus?
Well, right now I'm very pessimistic that our chances for a negotiated solution with the Taliban are very good. For one thing, the Taliban don't want to talk to us right now. For another, they feel that they're winning, mm-hmm. and they feel that they can wait us out. In his West Point speech, President Obama said that we will be drawing down troops by July 11th. So the question is, if we already have one foot out the door, why should they talk to us? There's nothing to negotiate. They can simply be patient and then take over the country as we exit. And so if we're going to negotiate with the Taliban, we have to somehow correct the impression that we're already being chased out of the country. And unless we do that, there's no incentive, really. There's no leverage that we have on them to come to the table. Interestingly, the best way forward for a negotiated solution, I believe, lies with Pakistan taking the lead. They have the military force in order to pressure the Taliban. They have the intelligence service that has those insights. In fact, many of the Taliban may be on their payroll. And third, they have the strategic patience. They're not going anywhere. And therefore, the Taliban realize at some point they're going to have to deal with the Pakistanis. And so the question is, can we then work hand in hand with Pakistan to craft a negotiated solution? We're a ways away from doing that right now. There's going to be a December review that General Petraeus will be giving the president. We'll have a little bit more clearer picture of what the administration's policy is at that time.
Now, I can't let you go without asking this question, because this is of particular interest to me. And you talked about how in American history, we negotiated with the Barbary pirates, and we were even giving them money. We had it written that they were getting kind of a bailout, I guess, you know, in the days before Goldman Sachs.
$2 million a year.
$2 million a year. That went a little bit further back then. What about the Somali pirates? I'm not kidding. Somali pirates are becoming such an important force in that country. They actually have now ground troops in Somalia. So they're sort of a quasi-terrorist,
criminal gang.
Criminal gang.
Yeah.
Do you at some point, does it make sense for international representatives to speak to the Somali pirates?
Well, part of the problem is really twofold. There's a local problem and there's a larger problem here. The local problem is it's not clear that this is organized crime. It's disorganized crime. There are probably lots of these individualized groups. You could talk to one, but there would still be dozens of others that would continue to do their business. The larger problem is ungoverned territories, that the central government in Somalia doesn't have control over its own territory and doesn't have a monopoly of force. There are increasingly more and more states like this, and this is going to continue to grow as a problem for us.
Well, I'm going to have to declare this talk with a Somali pirate day. Thank you so much for coming on our show today. My guest has been Mitchell Reese. His book, Negotiating with Evil, When to Talk to Terrorists, is published by Open Road. Mitchell Reese will be speaking and signing books tonight at 6:30 at the Cooper Union. For more information about tickets and location, you can check out our show page at WNYC.org. Mitchell, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Andy. The book is also available at your favorite online retailer.